right now, it is time for Oh the Humanities, taking a look at humanities research, scholarship, and events on and around campus. And we are joined now in the studio, as always, by the guru of UNC Humanities, Max Orr of Carolina Public Humanities. How are you?
I'm doing well. You're running out of ways to describe me. I like this
I've
one,
though.
I've
got a big old thesaurus.
Guru of Public Humanities.
Of the internet.
Yeah, indeed. Any word you want to choose. I also like the way you pronounced Moog. I'm very pleased with that.
Got that right.
Yeah. I think so. At least that's the way I understand it.
Everyone, you had to read it. Yeah.
Thank you, Aaron, for having me. As always, actually, I haven't done it for a little bit, but I did bring some dates. Today is April 30th, and I'm going to try to figure out how these tie into our topic, and they really don't, but I just want to say it's very interesting that in 1789, George Washington took the oath of office to become our first president today.
There you go.
In 1905, and another big moment that has some import, Albert Einstein completed his doctoral thesis.
Wow.
So, 1905.
Is he one of those people who had already achieved all of his greatness and then went on to complete his doctoral thesis, or did that come after?
I need to do a little bit more research. My understanding, though, is that his one of his great laws of relativity came out in 1905.
So maybe it was his doctoral dissertation.
Right
around there, yeah.
Maybe it was indeed his dissertation. I know mine was that important. And then in 1993, this is getting a little closer. CERN, which is the international body overlooking the internet, announced that the World Wide Web protocols would be free and therefore destroyed democracy for the rest of the world. At any rate, so this is why we are able to have such access. That wasn't determined that how they're going to handle the WWW protocols. Mm-hmm. And in 1993, they determined that they would be free.
Free as opposed to what, trying to trademark it
now I'm way over my head. Let's just go back to Einstein.
Okay, good, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not get into the theories, but at any rate, maybe...
Sir Rowan Fall is a humanities scholar for coming right in with the general relativity.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So maybe I'm going to try to put this together somehow. We have a president of a polity. We have knowledge in the form of Albert Einstein, and we have a vehicle for the transmission of knowledge. This is what we call thinking on your toes, because it leads us to our guest, who is an expert we have brought in at the university to help transmit knowledge, a very particular type of knowledge, and that knowledge is, of course, the humanities. So I'd like to welcome Robin Schrader. She is the director for the Humanities for the Public Good Initiative, which is a very generous grant put out by the Mellon Foundation to help us promote the humanities throughout the state of North Carolina, to help use our faculty in the best way possible to increase the public good through knowledge. So, Robin, welcome.
Happy to be here. I will say I already have one more connection to your events, which is it comes up explicitly very seldom now in my day job, but my own dissertation research was on popular constitutionalism, and the year 1789 will turn out to be an important one.
Awesome.
What was your
dissertation on?
I looked at case studies of people who you don't normally think of as having a role in constitutional interpretation in forming political ideas and in some cases uprising. So for example, I looked at a group of former slaves who were colonists in Liberia who had a bit of a revolt against the American Colonization Society in 1835 over press rights mainly, and also the right to bear arms.
Awesome. That sounds really cool.
It wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. Kept me on my toes.
Yeah, definitely.
And,
all right.
And now you're here to promote everyone's work.
That's right.
In a way. So one of the things, Robin has already worked with us extensively with our community college outreach program. I know you've had Rachel Shavitz in your talking about. So a lot of that is being funded through this initiative, but there are many more initiatives. So I'm going to press Robin to talk a little bit about the overarching idea of the grant first, and then maybe sort of think about some projects that are going and where we stand in the process. So tell us about the grant in general.
Yeah, so the Humanities for the Public Good Initiative, and I'll say HPG from now on to save your ears, is a four-year, $1.5 million initiative, largely funded by the Mellon Foundation, that's trying to do two things. One is to recognize and legitimate the public humanities scholarship that we've already had at the university for a long time. And one of the things that people in the public humanities movement know is that there was a public humanities before there was the phrase public humanities. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to bring that up to the surface, to raise the credibility of it, and to make it a little bit easier to do with the various kinds of resources along with funding that we have.
So for people who are kind of just getting into this, public humanities just in general is like humanities research, but then like taking it out to the public, right?
The phrase public humanities really as a noun phrase started being used in the 80s in the context of really of the culture wars. So you see after the foundation of the NEH, a bunch of politicians in the state humanities councils trying to talk about the work that they're trying to do, which is somehow bridging knowledges between academics and publics. Interestingly, at the time, there's a bit of a fight on, well, we call it applied humanities, and then we're really talking about trying to get humanities scholars to run writing programs and paint with people, mm-hmm. or will we call it something else? Mm-hmm. Out of public humanities, you get quite a theoretical bent to community-university collaboration, which we're talking about when we talk about public humanities still evolving as a term as it gets institutionalized in the last 20 years.
That's really cool. So what is the work that you do on campus?
So first and foremost, my job is to manage the grant. So the grant has major categories for faculty community collaborations and the Critical Issues Project Fund. We just funded 5 really amazing projects out of that. We have a few other grants to faculty for project-based courses and for engagement with communities. And then we have 2 different kinds of awards for graduate students. So graduate students who we see as the sort of next generation having a new set of capacities that will really change the university. We're awarding the under-recognized public service and public scholarship work that they, again, have already been doing. So those are so-called non-service awards. And then we're catalyzing new work. So I just was happy last week to send out notifications to our inaugural cohort of so-called Humanities Professional Pathway awardees who will do applied research that has a public orientation embedded in cultural institutions around really mostly this community, but also in a couple of cases around the world.
Does the grant come with certain strings? Is it targeted towards a particular type of scholarship, or is it just sort of a blanket grant, do with it what you will?
We have defined the award categories with certain kinds of projects in mind. So it's not an accident that I just said applied research.
Yeah, I heard that applied, yeah, coming in.
We really want to see public humanities find legs in the university. And without evaluating these project-based forms of work people are doing, getting data out of that evaluation, and without thinking of it as being research, it's going to be very hard to give it credibility over the long term in the university, meaning it'll keep being kind of at the edges and precarious, something people do in centers and programs, but not in traditional departments.
What Robin is doing is ties in, so you could see we're both sort of approaching this, if you will, challenge. And the challenge is to make it clear to the public that the humanities are relevant, important, and can provide incredible benefits being transmitted, you know, being taken off of campus. And we're trying to work on that in the humanities, in Carolina Public Humanities. And for many people, they think of this as just something that is it's outside of the university. It's just outreach. It's just, and so we do a lot of outreach, and that's our job, is to bring public programs to the public in through our lectures or through the community college programs we have, or through Carolina K-12. And I think from Robinson, you're also trying to make it the buy-in come from the faculty itself. And so we can work in these two directions and saying, you know, we have all sorts of venues, if you will, or opportunities for you to do this type of work, but we also want to see it being generated on the faculty and scholarship side from the very beginning. And I think Robin's initiative can bring that to the faculty in a much more direct way than we can, although, again, we're working on the same project from sort of different directions, but with the same goal in mind.
That seems perfectly right. And to see this as a sort of spectrum of understanding how the university sets up how people work is one of the easiest ways to explain it. So maybe more concretely, I could talk about 2 of the projects
Please.
That kind of different
yeah,
poles that we
yeah.
funded through the Critical Issues Project mm-hmm. Fund. So these projects are by the design of the call for proposals at really different stages. One, quite speculative. So the Southern Oral History Program is starting a new initiative. They've called it Stories to Save Lives. It's going to be a long-standing program. They'll be at it for 3 to 5 years. And their goal is to start this summer piloting a research project on the question of how can oral history serve public health goals. Oral history as a method and as a discipline. Mm. So it's quite a research-based project, and it's also just now getting off the ground. And the number of possible collaborators and applications, it's a little mind-boggling, actually. A really exciting project.
That project is interesting because it could go both in sort of community-collected stories as well as personal narratives, and the two of them, you could get different types of information from those.
Exactly right. So patient narratives are an individual-based story that is culturally contingent, and understanding mm-hmm. cultures is one of the projects of oral history. So mm-hmm. it's very exciting. On the other end, we have Professor Seth Koch's implementation grant for his longstanding Red Record project.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is a digital database of lynchings around the country, which has largely been annotated thus far by class after class worth of his students who've dug into the primary sources to try and find and locate these stories, which have taken place in almost every state in the mm-hmm. union. Now, what Seth wants to do is to, on the one hand, professionalize this, move it from a student-based to a sort of historian-based resource to make it more usable for people beyond this campus, and also to make it useful for teachers. So he partnered with Christy Norris from Carolina yep. K-12, who's part of the Carolina
We've
Public Humanities Initiative,
as well, right?
To set up a teacher's development institute to be able to use this resource in their teaching, particularly because it's such a difficult topic to teach and mm-hmm. the resources that exist have been mm-hmm. so relatively scanty. So he's been at this for quite a long time, and so this is at the sort of implementation end, I think, of the kinds of projects that we're seeing.
And I mean, that right there is a really cool project because it manifests itself in a whole bunch of different ways, right? You've got the actual research into our history, which then informs our present, including the conversations that we're having literally right now, this second, in Orange County in a couple of different very specific locations. You've got the extent to which it's a project that encourages university students, undergraduates, to do research and teaches them how to do that. And then they do it in a way that you can then take to high schools and say, here, teach this. Here's a resource that you can then communicate to high school students or middle school students or below.
Hitting a lot of registers at once and actually helping all of the people. Yeah. I mean, you have to think about the different kinds of incentives. It fits into his teaching, which is mm-hmm. something the university does incentivize mm-hmm. him to do, unlike public projects. So this is a great kind of example of a project. I will say, really frequently, I think what we see is that undergraduates are some of the most excited people to get involved in this because they can see so clearly, in some cases much more clearly than faculty tend to, the social contexts and contingencies that surround the text that they're, the 19th mm-hmm. century romantic poetry that they're reading, mm-hmm. say. So I just got a note this last week from Professor Jean Moskal in the English department, who her class put up an exhibition on the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein, which is staring us in the face.
We just talked about it last week.
Yeah.
And what she said is that her undergraduate students were so excited to have this sort of institutional opportunity to explain what they'd been learning to other people, to sort of build a bridge, which is what things like exhibition, curation, dialogue, facilitation, and holding public events and programs can do. And we're missing some opportunities if we don't give undergraduates some room to take some charge of that.
Speaking Absolutely. With Max Orr, of course, Carolina Public Humanities. Humanities.unc.edu is the website. We've also got Robin Schrader from the Humanities for the Public Good Project, grant from the Mellon Foundation. What is your background? Like, how did you come to this position?
My background in public humanities started when I first graduated from undergrad. I went to go work for a set of museums, including the Abraham Lincoln Home National Historic Site, as a museum educator. And I got really invested in the questions of the differences between what cultural institutions, including universities, know and what the sort of mass public knows from serving as a museum educator and seeing that gap face to face. So I came to graduate school in first with an MA in public humanities and then my PhD in American studies at Brown with a set of questions about public consciousness and public knowledge versus institutional and elite and expert knowledges. I stayed at Brown after I finished my dissertation to work at the John Nicholas Brown Center for Public Humanities and Cultural Heritage. And I was running academic programs. I served as director of graduate studies. And I was trying to figure out the professional information that I needed to have to sort of be the crown in my jewel, so to speak, which is, how does the university work? And how do faculty think? And why isn't this case for public humanities as much of a slam dunk as it seems to young people? And that is involves a set of structural and cultural problems, which is are really Max's and my job to make interventions into.
You know, what's interesting about, you know, you hear this, what's the name of the center at Brown? Is the John
Nicholas Brown Center for Public Humanities.
Center for Public
Heritage.
Humanities is the part I really care about. No offense to Mr. Brown, but I mean, the thing is
the fact
is that
it's Brown at Brown, is that just a coincidence
there
or is it
so
the same
Browns.
Family?
Okay. Yeah.
But the idea that there are these centers throughout, you know, and people in universities think that, and we were just talking about this before we came on, that, you know, well, we're the only people out there really doing public humanities. And I think one of the things that this initiative shows is it's a zeitgeist, if you will, that throughout the country, it's not just UNC that's doing this. There's the Mellon Foundation is aware of it. And there is, I mean, we've had this conversation, Aaron, in many different ways about the need for humanities education and humanities outreach because of the sort of critical state of critical thinking, not to use the word critical twice, but three times there. At any rate, and also just the general sense that they're devalued, right? Every education has to have some sort of monetary value, and we don't appreciate Jill Adams, Maynard Adams' daughter, Maynard Adams was the founder of our program, had a wonderful way of describing the oblique gains of the humanities and getting us to sort of, you don't have to have this, you know, bludgeon to say, here's the value of the humanities, but boy, I became a more empathetic person. I became a person able to understand other cultures. I became a person who realizes that the world is a little bit deeper than yesterday. You know, all of these things.
That's an interesting set of questions. One of the things that occurs to me when I'm sitting around naming and trying to argue against what I think are the most common objections to public humanities, some of which are also common objections to digital humanities. The main one I think that I hear or almost hear is that we're trying to vocationalize the humanities. We're trying to turn it into something that gives people professional skills. So now you can go work in a museum, a nonprofit, a cultural institution. And part of me thinks, well, so what? That seems perfectly reasonable against the cost of education right now. We could have a different set of questions about what a university is for if the structures looked a little bit different. But part of me also thinks that that's just not this vocationalization conversation and this meaning threat that vocationalization represents mostly to faculty. It's not a way that young people think. They don't make separations exactly at that age, maybe ever, and this moment in history between the way what they want to do in their professional lives and what they're learning in school. Those boundaries are just too porous for them. So it's a fight that's worth having. I think I had an extremely traditional humanities education as an undergrad at Wesleyan in the College of Letters. But and I really believe in the humanities classroom as a place where you can just read a book and put your mind through the mental gym that is critical thinking and reflection. But I also think it's not it's no meaning threat to have a set of alternatives and an array of other kinds of applications of the problems that we're facing. So
absolutely, we certainly know. I mean, I can talk about the practical benefits of the humanities, and I believe them. But I always want to stress that, you know, that's half maybe even less than half of what this is, because the far more practical value is it creates thinking citizens, thinking community, caregivers, compassionate people, you know, all of these things that are lacking at times if we just focus on instrumental education.
So I don't want to jump in with this at exactly this moment, but we need to take a commercial break. So as we wrap up this conversation, what more should people know about the Mellon Grant, the Humanities for the Public Good? And if people want to get more information, find out more about the projects that are being funded, where can they go?
They can go to hbg.unc.edu. That's the Humanities for the Public Good Initiative's website. It lays out our grants and our open calls. They can find my email and reach out to me anytime.
Awesome. hpg.unc.edu for the humanities for the public good. Humanities.unc.edu for more on Carolina Public Humanities. Any upcoming events? I know we're getting to semester.
We got one weekend seminar left. I'll be back to talk about the summer.
Sounds good. Max Orr, Robin Schrader, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.